Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. If you enjoy this or any other episode of The Realignment, I'd appreciate if you could go to realignment.supercast.com. It's how we monetize and support the show. For today's episode of The Realignment, I'm speaking with Nick Santanam, one of the authors of The Titanium Economy, How Industrial Technology Can Create a Better, Faster, Stronger America. Nick and his co-authors argue that the modern, reinvented industrial sector is going to play a central role in revitalizing the American economy over the next decade. He also upends a lot of the conventional wisdom about the weakness of the manufacturing sector that's left over from the 70s and 80s. We discuss the key industries that make up the titanium economy, how 21st century manufacturing differs from our nostalgia-tinted image of its 50s heyday, the geopolitical and structural economic changes fueling American manufacturing, how the titanium economy will help boost wages, fuel the middle class, and spur economic growth outside the coasts, and how young people and workers can access careers in the space even if they haven't followed the traditional higher education path. I spent a lot of time on this topic lately, and I just can't emphasize enough how exciting it is. It's pretty clear that the political side of things is going to be stuck in a rut/loop for the next few cycles. Trends like the manufacturing boom as the world deglobalizes is exactly the sort of shift the chessboard needs that will allow our system and people within it to produce different outcomes. On another note, Sagar and I are recording an episode with friend of the show Alex Kantoritz's Big Technology Podcast, so no discussion episode tomorrow. The newsletter will still be out, though, so check the podcast show notes to subscribe to the Substack. Huge thank you to LinkedIn for supporting the show. Hope you all enjoy this episode. Nick Santanam, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall. Thanks for having me.
I like when a book has a subtitle that kind of speaks to an interesting idea. I want to kind of start there. What does a better, faster, stronger America look like to you? Like when you think of those words, like what does that embody?
Marshall, it comes down to a very simple sentence for me, right? It comes to having where a sector and then the companies are doing well for themselves, making a lot of money. But as they do that, they do well for the broader ecosystem where they play in, whether that be their suppliers. And I use the word suppliers very broadly. There are two suppliers of capital and suppliers of talent, or whether they're doing well for the ecosystem of the communities they play in. And as we do that, I think industrial sector has been doing this for the last multiple decades. And I think as the sector continues to grow, it's going to continue to do that.
You know, when you talk about a sector doing well for itself, but then also the broader country doing well, I instantly thought of the 1950s where, you know, the famous testimony, what's good for Ford is good for America. I think a lot of our vision of maybe let's put aside the bad parts of the 1950s, but at least when it came to the economic reformance, the growth, supporting households, when you think of the transition point between that 50s, 60s, height of what people would say would be the post-World War II boom today, how would you articulate those 40 to 50 years in between now and then?
You know, Marshall, I sort of think about this and say, you know, when you look at the sector, this is a sector where people say, they think about it in one of those nostalgic times, as you said, right, the 50s, and say, oh my God, that were great times, right? And I stop them and say, actually, you know what, folks? We are in for even better terms. If you thought the 50s was great, the 2020s and 2030s are even going to be better. And the question is very simple, right? Because I truly believe the industrial sector and the industrial tech sector, the best days are ahead of us. And this also was the genesis why we wrote this book, right? Because people often look and say, oh my God, is this a sector which was stolen, lost, given away? Is our best days given away? And I always stop people and say, folks, let me stop you. Why do you say that, right? Because I'm going to give you three statistics, Marshall, and then I'll let you decide whether the good days are ahead or, you know, better things are there to come. There are 460 counties in this country where manufacturing and industrial jobs are more than 20% of the jobs, number one, right? Number two is a manufacturing job pays on an average or industrial job, and I'm going to use those words interchangeably, today, pays $63,000 per year, while a services job pays $30,000. And the best part is people, the news tends to sort of focus on, hey, 65% of the job creation today is happening in 25 urban areas on the East Coast or the West Coast. And the industrial sector is actually neutralizing that or diluting that, where more than 80% of the jobs are being created in what I call the Middle Coast, right? Not the East Coast, not the Middle Coast. So when you look at these three statistics, it's amazing, right? I mean, you look at it, it's unbelievably a vibrant community, a vibrant sector, right? 20% in 460 counties. That's a pretty impressive number. It is extremely high paying, right? I mean, $63,000. And as you will probably see in our book, there are multiple companies, not one, not two, where there are employees who joined the companies and are retiring with $1 million in their account between 401k and their retirement accounts. And this is a sector which continues to say, you know, the only problem we have is we don't have enough people, right? I mean, the sky is the limit. We're doing well. We could get more. So when you put all of that together, I say, boy, you know, we are in a period of untapped, uncapped growth. So now I'll come to your question. 40s, 50s was great. Love it. But we haven't yet seen the best days. And what we bring to the bear, right, as an industrial sector, an industrial tech sector, and what we bring to bear as this country is we have all the ingredients. We have amazing talent. We have amazing capital, right? We have unbelievable demand. And I think the last 3 years has made it very clear that you do need a very strong industrial base. God forbid if a COVID 2.0 kind of happens, right? You really need to control your destiny. And to do that, you need an industrial base, right? And so all the ingredients are coming together to now bring this to the limelight to say, hey, this is a sector which is not only was a great sector, which it is for sure, but it can be a great sector going forward.
I think the key takeaway, and you all hit this in the sort of preface chapter of the book, this real pushback on this idea that the conventional pessimism folks have about manufacturers is incorrect. So can you like basically just give us a vision of it? Because I think part of the reason why we're focused on decades, 40s, 50s, 60s, is that there's a narrative story. And I think the narrative story that folks would understand is going into the 1970s, the U.S. economy financializes, you have globalization, and then you start deprioritizing manufacturing. It goes to East Asia, it goes to Mexico. And then what you also have happen, obviously, as well, too, is you actually have like services and the financial industry are going to improve the American economy. We're going to leave this old 50s, 60s world in the past. What actually happened in your corrective telling then during this period that makes you, I guess I can say someone saying one should be optimistic about the way the sector looks like right now at this moment?
Marshall, you got to the genesis of our book, right? Our book basically started off by saying, look, this is a sector which is misunderstood, undervalued, and unappreciated. Or put it differently, perception is not equal to reality, right? So let me start off by saying, why is it misunderstood? Misunderstood because exactly as you said, people say, oh, gee, you know, industrials. Industrials is not one homogeneous monolith. It's 90 plus micro verticals. As I jokingly say, it's the Amazon rainforest and it's the Sahara desert, right? I mean, you can't really compare it, right? So you have to go at the micro vertical level. It's also misunderstood for this very reason. You know, when people think of industrials, they think about the bad part of the 40s and the 50s, right? Like workers working in dirty environment, long, loud, noisy environment, you know, people getting killed in accidents and so on. And the reality today is if you walk into a manufacturing floor in the US or for that matter anywhere, it's clean, air conditioned, right? Computer controlled, right? It's a place you want to work for, right? Or you want to work in. And it's also misunderstood because exactly as you said, it's one of those people say, oh, you know, there are more sexy sectors like, and you can fill in the blanks, or more sexy companies like, fill in the blanks. And then you sort of look at the data, right? And we profile more than 35 companies in the book. There are multiple companies, not one, not two, which over the last decades have done significantly better in their stock price valuation, right? So if I use that economics, and rewarded their shareholders better than the usual suspects, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Netflix of the world. And we have profiled one company, and it's not an exception, but I just want to call that out. If you look at Heiko, and I'm pretty sure if you're not in the sector, you probably wouldn't know that company, and you'll probably go Google it up and say, you know, did I hear it right? It's a company over the last 30 years has outperformed pretty much most, if not all, of the tech companies people talk about or people hear on CNBC. And yet it's a company most people don't know, but it's felt in everything you and I do. Put it differently, they make the parts which goes into planes. The Mars rover, when it went to, you know, when it went to Mars, obviously, to get the temperature sensitivity, they did that. So it's one of those things where it's the unsung hero or the unheard hero. But that's the whole point, which is we're like, it's a very misunderstood sector. Then when you look at the undervalued and unappreciated, Marshall, is if you look around, most of the stuff, when you wake up, and we wrote about it in the first chapter, if you wake up in the morning and do your normal stuff, you go out, stand in your patio, enjoy your sunrise, you decide to fly out, you rush to the airport, decide to get a muffin heated up in like less than 30 seconds, assuming you're in Phoenix or Minneapolis, where it's too hot or too cold and you're boarding the plane. All of those innovations are done by the industrial sector. Like, for example, when you're standing in your patio, the wood, which is created from recycled material, is very durable. It's created by a company called Prex, which most people have not heard about. You go to the airport, you're in a rush, you're waiting in your line for a Starbucks, so you want to get a muffin heated up or a bagel, and gets heated up in 30 seconds in a very uniform way, doesn't get burnt up, makes it well, from an innovation from a company called Velvet. You're boarding the plane and, you know, you don't want to be too hot or too cold. It's innovation in what's called ground support equipment done by companies like Dabico and JBT, and the list goes on. And yet, you know, you'd sort of say, wait a minute, these were all not done in the 40s. These were innovations which are happening now, right? It's the bedrock is happening now. I mean, obviously, you know, I like to have a hot cup of coffee. I like to be warm or cold when I'm boarding the plane. And those are innovations which are happening now. It's a very vibrant community. And so back to your point where you started the discussion, none of this is I'm talking about the 40s and the 50s. I'm talking about this happening in the 90s and the 2000s and so on. And this is a sector that's why you look and say, well, actually, I really got this wrong, right? I mean, if I really didn't dig in, I didn't de-average the sector, this is a sector which is pretty vibrant, pretty doing well, paying its employees well, creating a lot of millionaires. And the best part or the worst part, I'll let you decide. They are in tier two and tier three cities. They're not in San Francisco. They're not in New York. They're in cities you and I would probably wouldn't have heard of, which is a very thriving community. This is where we call the great amplification cycle, creating, you know, a lot of great jobs, you know, creating great families, creating great experiences. And in cities you and I haven't heard about, which is what makes America, America, right? It's not New York or San Francisco or Atlanta or Boston. It's these cities. And the enabler of all of this is the industrial sector, right? So back to the point, that's what made us write this book, saying, guys, it's not about the past. It's the right now. It's the engine which drives this country. It is the engine which drives our economy. And yet, you know, people talk about it as if a battle we lost. It's like the Battle of Waterloo. And we're like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? We are not only winning that war, we are actually exceeding and getting ahead of it right now as we speak.
You know, a couple questions come to mind thinking about that. The first question would really come down to how much of what you're describing is due to, let's say, COVID. I like thinking about things this way. Like, let's say there had never been COVID. Let's say we weren't talking about supply chains. Let's say we aren't talking about a complicated geopolitical situation in the Asia Pacific, to put it lightly.
Yeah.
Would the story that you're telling in this book have been true if March 2020 hadn't happened?
Absolutely. Right. So let me give you an example. Let me start with a statement and then I'll give an example. About 10 years ago, one of my clients said that. He said, Nick, do you realize we are in the basement while the party happens in the penthouse? And I said, that's very interesting, John. Why do you say this? He says, look, you really don't know what we do, but everybody knows what happens in the penthouse. And the reason I say this is I think whether it is the COVID or the geopolitical tensions, Marshall has just made it people wake up and realize it. But the reality is this has been around for decades. So semiconductors is a great example, right? I mean, Biden's signed the CHIP Act, the supply chain happened during COVID, and it all became a big issue. But let me sort of tell you, semiconductor matters, don't get me wrong, but the machinery which does semiconductor manufacturing, precision manufacturing, is all in the US. It's been in the US, will be in the US hopefully, and that is driving the innovation. And we didn't talk about it till now, right? So back to my point, all of this has been around. It's not like COVID changed anything. COVID only made it clearer to people saying, wow, you know, let me actually think about it. This is such an important sector that I should have thought about it. Back to the analogy, right? I've been focusing on the penthouse when I really should be looking at the basement. I mean, again, if you look at statistics, Marshall, during COVID, more than 85% of industrial companies ran like normal, meaning no change in how they did. The CEO showed up to work, CFO showed up to work, the frontline showed up to work. Not because they had to, not because they were mandated, because that's how they work, right? That was critical to keep the lifeline running. So to answer your question, did COVID change anything? I think it just put the limelight on the sector, flashlight on. But, and if you look at the data, that's the best part. Unlike tech or unlike consumer, where you saw a huge spike up and down, it's business as usual, right? They created their products, they kept the lights on, and they were the unsung heroes because they were unsung heroes before and they were unsung heroes then.
I'd like you to tell a story from the book that came to mind when you're describing the difference between the semiconductor, you know, microchip creation process, right? So that's where we're talking about Taiwan. We did a recent episode on this. And the actual in the United States part, I'm thinking of how in the book, I think this is in the second or third chapter, during the real semiconductor chip shock, when the entire U.S. industrial sector had a five-day supply remaining, when back in 2019, this is citing your statistics, there was a 40-day supply. Tesla was able to convert a million chips to actually be able to be utilized. So I'm dramatically oversimplifying something complicated, but I'd love you just to really explain that, because I think folks are interested in the semiconductor space, but it's unclear how this actually operates beyond just a, we should build a big fab somewhere.
Yeah, Marshall, it's a great thing, right? Like anything, it's the tip of the iceberg. So if you look at semiconductors, for the viewers or the readers who don't know, semiconductor manufacturing is the typical manufacturing. You take a wafer and you etch very fine features on it. Unfortunately, that is a battle. I don't want to say we lost, but we gave up in the 80s and the 90s when a lot of the manufacturing went to Thailand, Taiwan and Korea and so on. I mean, we still have manufacturing here, but I mean, once upon a time, all of semiconductor manufacturing in the US was north of 65%. Today, the number is down to 20%. So you'll say, God, this is bad, and this is why you have the CHIPS Act, and this is why you have companies like Intel building fabs here. You know, and we should absolutely do it. Don't get me wrong, we should control our destiny. But back to my unsung hero, now let's look at the machinery which makes the semiconductors, right? The actual fabrication. The three big companies, Applied Materials, Lam Research, and KLA Tencor, they're all based within a 5-mile radius of each other in San Jose, California, right? They're not in Taiwan. They're not in Korea. They're not anywhere else. And then two other companies which are more, not more important, equally important, is a company called ASML in Netherlands and a company called Tokyo Electron in Tokyo. These five companies, God forbid, if let's say they just stop working, you cannot make a single semiconductor anywhere in the world, period. It doesn't matter where your fabs are. It doesn't matter what it is. So I think it's a really good position, I would say, when three out of five companies are based in the US and within a 5-mile radius in San Jose, right? And again, this is not a political topic, and fortunately, I'm not that smart to get into politics, so not to get into it. But you look, five out of the five companies are in the Western hemisphere or the Western sphere of influence. So it's a very interesting point. You look at it and you say, wow, now, and if you look at the latest pushbacks or not the push, the sanctions and everything, that's what the US government is saying, right? Saying, hey, if you're a US manufacturer, you can't ship to, you know, China and all that. That shows you, like, where, to your point, semiconductor, the heart of semiconductor manufacturing, which is industrial, right? That's precision manufacturing, sits in the US.
You know, something I'm curious about, another statistic that comes from the book is that despite the stock performance, despite the very tangible need, less than 1% of venture capital is directed towards this broad industrial sector. I'd love for you to answer the question kind of in two different ways. So the first way would be, okay, why is that, given the stock performance issue? So this isn't purely a matter of, well, it's so impressive, but the stock market just doesn't give any illustration of how successful this could be. That's not quite happening. So what's going wrong here? And then two, is there, how actually then are these companies funded in the first place then?
You know, Marshall, fantastic question again, right? When Tesla IPO'd in 2011, I had lunch with Elon Musk before he was this wildly famous. And I looked at him and I said, Elon, you know, $1 billion, I mean, you IPO, take the money and run. And he looked at me and said, Nick, you're wrong. This is going to be worth $1 trillion. And I thought to myself, what an idiot, right? And well, guess who the idiot is. But the reason I say the story is, I think, Marshall, Tesla has made it very clear that in the industrial space, you can make money, right? So the floodgates is starting, point number one. I think, look, this is like true in any space, and VCs are no exception. VCs run where the first guy ran, right? So they're, I mean, as much as VCs would want to say they are trendsetters, they're not. And this is the reason also we, right, folks at Fernway, you know, said, hey, look, we believe in this. And we started Fernway, right? Fernway is an investment company which focuses exclusively on the industrial space because we said, look, let's go where, you know, people are not focusing, because if we do that, we'll make more money. So I think the floodgates are opening, Marshall. You will see more and more of it. And if you see in our book, what we call the two biggest suppliers, supplier of talent and supplier of capital, are coming in. It's a matter of time. It's not if, it's when it's going to happen. And you're already starting to see it. We as Fernway want to be the first in the crowd. So that's allowing us to be ahead. And to your question, how have they funded so far? It's the classic American spirit, pure grit. If you look, several industrial companies are family owned. So they believe in it. They fund themselves. And companies which get into the public space do well in their operations, right? They create real revenue, they create revenue cash flow, and they fund themselves. I mean, I'm based here in Silicon Valley. I don't want to make a dig at anybody, but in Silicon Valley, the very thought can get you $1 billion funding, right? You don't have to have a product. You don't have to have a company. If I think about something cool, you'll fund me for $1 billion. It's a joke, but it's true. There's a lot of companies. You don't find that many of that in industrial. So in industrial, you have to prove it, right? And that's been the model for the last few decades. More than the last few decades, and that has worked very well, right? Because people say, look, in the typical VC setting, in the typical Silicon Valley setting, you get paid for what you think you're going to do. In industrials, you get paid for what you got done. And so people say, let's go get it done, right? And as they say, the proof is in the pudding. They go get it done and good things happen after that.
Something I'm curious about here. I want to go back to something you said earlier. This is also illustrated in the book when you're describing how looking at these modern factories, oftentimes they're clean. There's a mix of like automation and in-person. And this is obviously bringing to mind kind of like the micro, like dirty jobs articulation. And I'm wondering, to editorialize for a quick second, it seems to me that while I think what Mike does is valuable, if I hear a narrative for 10 or 12 years, but the narrative doesn't actually change the underlying dynamic, I have to question whether the narrative is particularly useful. So we've heard for over a decade, oh, you know, there are always problems with the higher education system, but it turns out if you take a dirty job, you'll be plenty successful. It doesn't seem like that metaphor has quite been transformative. So I'm curious how you would maybe quibble or add to or kind of separate out like what you're seeing on the ground in a factory from maybe this sort of 2008 Discovery Channel version I'm bringing up from high school. Like, how would you think about this?
Marshall, to your point, right? The narrative is a narrative, right? I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's a lie. But the narrative is narrative, and the narrative is focused on pockets we have not done well, right? So if you look at James Will, the book was written. It was written about the auto industry. Auto industry, you know, didn't rightfully so. We had more than 50% market share in the U.S. in the 50s over time because of the Japanese competition and then the Korean competition. That number fell, and hence what happened is a lot of small towns, just as James Will, which was dependent on auto, fell apart. And that is factually accurate, right? There is no no two ifs and buts about it. But what we forget to tell is for every Jamesville, there's a Simpsonville, right? Simpsonville is a great, and we have it in our book, is a great example where, you know, there is a thriving community, right? It's not dependent on one company or one sector, right? You've got Sealed Air, which does packaging material. You've got BMW, which does auto. You've got Michelin Tires, which makes tires. And they've done very well for themselves, right? So I think when we look at narrative, we have to look at it holistically. It's very easy. And, you know, like every story has two sides. It's very easy to get that one narrative and say, boy, you know, the Jamesville's narrative, or even, you know, I always cringe at the word of the Rust Belt, right? I'm like, what Rust Belt are we talking about, right? And this is why we labeled our book the Titanium Economy, because we don't really believe the sector is rusting. We don't believe it's falling apart. It is resilient, it is shiny, and it's here to stay. Like titanium, it's going to be here forever. And yet the narrative has always been on, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's been on the one or two things which is not working. And my point is there are 98 things which are working. Let's talk about that. And back to my point, when you average it out or you aggregate it, Marshall, I'm telling you, we are in the first innings. The best days are yet to come.
Yeah, let's spend a second there. The use of the word titanium. I'm a Zoom podcaster. My job is about as far as could possibly be from the manufacturing economy. Like, what actually is titanium in comparison to, let's say, steel? And then why is this not the steel economy? Why is it the titanium economy right now in the way you phrase it in the book?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were all thinking, so I'll give you the genesis of how we came up with the word titanium, right? Because we were sitting and saying, what is this sector, right? And we looked at companies, and I said, we profiled 35 companies, whether it's Heiko, Casella, Trax, AZZ, Dabico, JBT, the list goes on. And we said, what is so common about, or what is a common theme, right? What we found is really there are three themes which stood out. One, every one of these companies were resilient, right? It didn't matter. When they hit their lows, they came, right? Two is they were not just good. They were really good. I mean, when I say is good, I mean, you look at their operational performance, financial performance, right? It's like, and the market rewarded them, right? They did better than their average. I mean, whether it's on multiple stock price. And the third thing is, look, never say never, Marshall, but you know, I look at these companies and I said, with a high level of comfort, I can say this company is going to be here, right? I mean, look, I am the last guy to bet on trends, right? So if you come to me and say, pick a tech company, let's take Zoom, right? You say, Nick, will Zoom be around in 3 years? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not, right? Maybe Teams will take on. Maybe, you know, there'll be a new set thing which you and I will talk about. Maybe there's a teleporting. I don't know. But I can tell you with a high level of confidence, these 35 companies are going to be around in 3 years, right? Because I still want my bagel heated up and I still want to stay warm on a plane and I still want a fuel being put into my plane. And so if you look at all three of them, they resemble titanium, that metal, right? They're very, so now let me compare steel versus titanium and, you know, rust. So let's start with rust. What is rust? Rust is iron, right? You take iron, you expose it, it rusts, it's not resilient, right? Two, they are really no different than any other metal, right? I mean, iron is iron. And 3 years, if you leave the iron out over a period of time, you just don't know whether it'll stay or not. I mean, it'll finally rust out and there won't be anything. Steel, you know, it's slightly better, right? Not a lot of better, a little better. It's shiny, right? But, you know, everything you and I use has got steel. So it's, I don't want to call it a commodity, but it's a commodity. Titanium, on the other hand, is special, right? It is not easy to process. You need special processing metals. It is resilient. And if you make something with titanium, let me tell you, it's going to withstand heat, temperature, pressure. You can put it through anything. That titanium is going to stay, right? And so that's why we looked and said, you know, is this company sector, is it steel? iron or titanium. And we all looked and said, it is really titanium, right? And so we labeled it the titanium economy because it is here to stay. It is resilient, right? It's better than everything else. And it really is truly a segment of one.
You know, something I'm wondering as you're articulating this, we obviously have a 50s, 60s era where certain types of manufacturing leave. So the semiconductors, many aspects of the auto industry, yet these firms, you know, the 35 firms you're describing, they are still here. Obviously, for example, one of the firms you're describing is in the waste pickup, disposal, recycling place. Obviously, that is not getting outsourced. But another one, and this is in the example you gave at the start of the guy on his patio, that's a firm that is taking like plastic bags and turning it into composites, like 1.5 billion plastic bags. That's like a fun image of just that many plastic bags is turned into a composite. Why would that have not outsourced? Do you get what I mean? Like what makes these firms resilient in the way that you're kind of telling this story?
So Marshall, let me take a detour and I'll answer your question, right? We acquired two companies, Dabico and Avia. Dabico has manufacturing locations in three places: Germany, London, Stockton-on-Tees, UK, and Cyprus, Southern California. All three of them are the highest cost locations. And Avail has got 7 locations, all of them in the US. I'm telling you this because I'm an investor in this company, so now it's my decision. I can move it. I'm not going to move it ever. And it's very simple. The reason I'm not going to move it is because the people and the IP in these locations is uncopyable, if that's the word, in other locations, right? Or put it differently, it is not a question of, oh, I'm going to move it because it's low cost. Because those sites, those talent, those people bring unbelievable value add to what they get paid. And if I move it elsewhere, I'm not going to make it, right? So I'm talking about two companies I know and I'm an investor.
Bad.
Will Trex move it? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not an investor. I don't run the company. But I'm going to say Trex probably has the same thing. They're smart. They know, right? And for that matter, if there's a Chinese or a Vietnamese company, it's going to be hard because it's not like what you do and I do is the same. It's a differentiated IP, right? They have the understanding of the technology. They have the understanding of the customers. They have the understanding of they have the relationship with the ecosystem. And as they say, this is not personal. Everything is business. I actually say it's the opposite, Marshall. In life, everything is personal. Nothing is business, right? People do it because it's very personal, right? I mean, if I'm the chairman of the company or I'm not, if I'm the CEO or I'm the plant manager, am I going to move it to China? Maybe, but I'm going to look and say, hey, if I can make money here and, you know, I've got the IP and I've got the brand and I have the know-how, I'm going to make it here, right? So sorry for the long-winded answer to your question, but
yeah.
I think that is the reason why a lot of look, you should always be on the lookout. You should always be cautious. But I do believe, you know, we are not chasing the lowest cost location. What we are chasing is the highest value applications. And as long as we create the highest value as a sector, you know, we'll compete and we'll win. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, no company, no sector wins, you know, because they have something which everybody else can copy. Because if that is the case, then everybody will move to the lowest cost location. I mean, why stop at China? You could go to Africa where it's cheaper and, you know, that should happen. It doesn't happen because IP and people, which matters, makes a big difference.
Something I'm wondering, you spoke a little bit about Elon Musk, and obviously like Elon's become controversial of late, but we're focusing more on like the 2010 Elon that you met with. If I'm thinking about the tech sector, we do a lot of Silicon Valley, VC tech-related episodes. If I think of founders in that space, there's a pretty straightforward, once again, narrative. Narratives are how people frame you. Maybe you go work at Google for a few years. You then leave Google and you like go work at an early stage startup. And once you've done that, you've been a PM, you found your own company. Like there's a pretty straightforward, the universe kind of works it out process for producing tech founders. Like there's a reason we don't have a national commission on like, how do we create more tech founders in this country? By contrast, and I don't know much about this space, so please educate me seriously. What does the process or narrative look like for finding founders in these companies? Because you have this really compelling line in the book where you say an optimistic future is one where there are 1,000 versions of Tesla. So obviously, like, massive companies defining in their verticals, how do you get the 999 founders to build that?
Yeah, the good news, Marshall, it's already there, right? What I mean by that is, if you'll see in our book, what you'll find is there are multiple, I don't remember the exact numbers. I think there's like north of 4,000 family-owned companies in the industrial space. There are 4,000 private-owned companies. They're all founders. They're all entrepreneurs, right? And they're doing well. They are, for most part, they're funded by their own, you know, their own blood, sweat, and equity. And they're not going away, right? Or put it differently, the 999 Elon Musk are actually today among us. You and I don't know about it because, you know, for every Elon Musk, there are 999 people don't talk about. But, and we talk about this in the book, a company called Captive Air, right? It's in Raleigh, North Carolina. Bob Luddy is the founder. He's in his mid-70s, and he'll talk, and he actually talks very eloquently about how we started this company to get better ventilation, right? Now you'll say, Nick, come on, ventilation is not that sexy. But if you're a chef in a commercial kitchen, trust me, it's important. You don't want to be smelling all the bad fumes. And when you're cooking, and nowadays with all this DoorDash and everything, you're cooking more and more food outside. The innovation he has done in HVAC, heating ventilation, is unbelievable, right? And that all came because he saw a problem. He understood the problem. He was close to the customer and he went and solved it, right? And he's done it over a 20-year period. But the best part, Marshall, is he's not a one-off. There are 4,000 Bob Luddies, right? Look, I think it is great to have an Elon Musk, all right? But we don't need to have an Elon Musk. I'm actually happy as a sector having 4,000 Bob Luddies because that's what makes the sector great. Because one of the interesting things about this sector vis-a-vis any other sector is this is a sector which does not market itself. This is the reason why we wrote the book, right? It's an unsung hero. It's back to the old thing, right? Everybody's in the basement while the party happens in the penthouse. But the basement is filled with amazing folks, right? It's just not the Elon Musk of the world you and I know or talk about as on the front page of CNBC talking about resolving Ukraine crisis or the Russian crisis. But there are enough Elon Musk who are solving an HVAC problem or a heating and cooling problem or an electrical grid problem, which we need to have a comfortable life as a society, right? And so to answer your question, it's already happening, right? We are not talking about it, but it's happening. And that's what makes so great the sector. And in a nice way, they said, you know what, guys, we don't need the VC funding. We'll fund it ourselves, right? I mean, now they're coming onto the capital markets. The capital markets treating them well. And that was also the genesis of why we wrote the book, right? I said, look, without any help, if they're doing this good, just imagine how good they would do with a little bit of help. Not a lot, with a little bit of help, how good they could do.
And that's so interesting when you're talking about brands and marketing. I'm wondering if it's just the maybe the era of manufacturing we're in, because if we're talking about the 40s, 50s, 60s, that produces incredible, you know, century-defining brands. Ford, obviously, GE, obviously, IBM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think it's just a reality of the stage of where we are with manufacturing technology that the defining opportunities are going to be in a microchip that goes into your cell phone versus here's this new phone brand that no one's ever heard of? Is that how we should kind of think about the differences between these two eras?
Marshall, the short answer, I don't know. But what I will tell you is it never hurts to market yourself, right? And this is what we wrote in the book is, look, this is a, you know, this is a sector which is a very silent giant, a benevolent giant, right? And you hit the nail on the head, right? I mean, in the 40s and the 50s, everybody knew the GM. But actually, there was no GM brand, right? There was Chevrolet, there was Oldsmobile, there was Pontiac. But everybody knew GM, right? Similarly, Intel, right? I mean, obviously marketed itself with Intel Inside, but Intel, really nobody should know, right? Because you bought a Lenovo or a Gateway or whatever was the brands during the 80s. And those companies did a really good job of marketing themselves. But you know what it really did is it increased awareness of the sector.
Yeah.
Till 2017, I can make you a wild guess, or maybe till 2015, a lot of people didn't know what semiconductors was. Semiconductors is a shitty industry. Today, it's a hard industry, right? But except for Intel, nobody knew the TIs of the world, the analog devices of the world, Atmels of the world. And this is what we write in the book, right? Marshall, I said, it's not because you want to market yourself for the sake of marketing, but if you want to attract, and this is where we truly believe the sector needs help, is if you want to attract the next generation of talent, because our biggest enemy, our biggest rate inhibiting step is getting enough good people, right? Younger generation, the trade, the welders, people going to all the good schools, manufacturing schools, MITs of the world, we want them to come work for us, right? We talk about it in the book. We say, we don't want you to go to the left coast or the right coast, come to the middle coast, right? Mm-hmm. And that is where all the jobs are. And to do that, you need to brand, right? And I tell the story, my kids are grown up, but when my son was 5 years old, he came to me and said, Dad, why don't you work for a cool company? All my friends work for Google and Apple, or their dads work for Google and Apple. You know, you talk about companies like JBT and Wellbuilt and Accudyne. Nobody has heard about them. You're not cool. And it was a joke, but, you can think about it, right, Marshall? Would you want to, your folks to think you're cool? And we all look for self-validation, right? And so there is, you can say, well, it doesn't matter. It does matter. And I think so. There is a big need just for us overall, right, to increase the sector, not the company, but the sector brand awareness. And I think that's going to be a huge force multiplier. And very honestly, that was one of the big reasons why we wrote this book, to say, guys, let's tell you how great the sector is, how cool the sector is.
So for the last section here, you've been very hopefully optimistic. I genuinely appreciate that. I think that I've done a bunch of episodes on this topic lately, and I think it's because there's a lot of very justified depression on the political and policy side of things. And it's exciting to see that there are, like you said, things happening in the basement that we're not paying attention to. But let's just do some scenario planning. You have this optimistic future. We wake up in 2031 and we say, wow, we really missed what was actually happening here. What goes wrong that prevents this optimistic future that you're describing? Like, what's like the worst case scenario? Is there a talent crunch in 2027? Is there a Taiwan crisis that cuts off chips? Like, how would you think of the next 10 years in terms of things going bad?
Marshall, it's a great point. And I would sort of say, I'm cautiously optimistic, right? Yeah. What I mean by that is I'm the kind of guy who sees a glass half full rather than half empty. So by no means am I saying, it is amazing going forward, right? What I do want to sort of say is, folks, we control our own destiny, right? And as the old adage goes, people who forget history are condemned to repeat it. So I want us to say, guys, let's look at you brought up the 40s and the 50s. And again, those are all facts, right? We did lose the edge on auto manufacturing. We did lose the edge on semiconductor manufacturing. And I'm saying, let's not do that again. And if you really are honest with yourself and say what went wrong, we were our worst enemy. What I meant by that is we woke up as a company, as a sector, as an economy, and said, well, that's not cool, right? Let Marshall in Timbuktu take over semiconductor manufacturing, not a big deal. Till we realize it's a big deal, and by then it was too late, right? So I think to answer your question, I think what can go wrong is if we become complacent, right? We're doing good. We can do great. We're not doing bad, but we can also go into an abyss and fail miserably if we become complacent as a sector, as a company, as a region, as an economy. So I think rule number one through rule number 99, I'm saying, we are our worst enemy, right? If we believe, right, that a manufacturing job is not important, a manufacturing sector is not important, and you made this point before, Marshall, right? Financial services is so much cooler than manufacturing, all bets are off, right? I tell this to people, I don't need any help, but don't kill me, don't block me, right? So I think rule number one is, this sector has done very well without any help, but let's not put up a roadblock, right? And we as a company, we as a sector, we as an economy can do that. Second is, you hit the nail on the head, right? We need talent. No ifs, no buts. Unfortunately, this is true in the US, but this is true in the world everywhere. The demographics are changing, right? More and more, I'm by no means into this topic, but people are getting married later. They're having kids later. They're having fewer kids. And you do the math very quickly. You know, we don't have that many people coming into the workforce than the people leaving the workforce. And if the people coming into the workforce, we don't forget greater than a fair share, even if we don't get our fair share, we're going to be in a lot of hurt. So I think most important thing is, we have to be on the lookout and make sure we get good talent, right? This is completely non-political statement. It doesn't do anything with immigration or something. My point is, if you have best talent, let's get it, right? Let's not worry about immigration issues or diversity issues. We have gone to a point where I truly believe, you know, we have to get the best folks into the sector. Now, let's put the elephant on the table, right? This is not a sector which is diverse. I mean, you can sort of look at the data, squint your eye and say, well, it's slightly better than the rest. But the rest itself is not great to begin with. So, you know, so we have to do our best to get the best talent. And fortunately or unfortunately, best talent is not restricted to one ethnic group or one religious group or one color. And so we have to make sure that we really build up a workforce of the best talent, right? And that we have to do as a company, as a sector. You look around, this is not a sector where there are a lot of women in the boardrooms in the top house. There is not that many talent of color. There's not that much talent of minorities, right? And so I think it's important that we just say, hey guys, we need to get the best talent, let's go get it. And then the last one, look, I am never believed in luck. Put it differently, macroeconomics is going to be macroeconomics. I can't predict whether, you know, inflation and interest rates are going to create havoc. I don't know what's going to happen in Russia, Ukraine. I can't know what's going to happen in China, Taiwan. But all I can say is, look, let's put our best foot forward. And if we put our best foot forward, as I said, right, being on the lookout, being paranoid that we're going to get killed, that means we have to be ahead of the race and make sure we have the best talent. Look, we're always going to win, right? I mean, if I'm ahead of everybody else, I'm looking out and I've got the best team on my side. That's the best I can ask. And I know with that, I'm always going to win.
So for the last two questions here, number one, when you're pointing out your answer on demographics, birth rates, an interesting subtext of that is, the issue in this industry isn't that there are all these jobs that are automated away and, you know, the only opportunities for the lead programmer who keeps all the machines running. There's actually, if anything, a shortage. So how does observing this space over, let's say, the last decade make you reassess the ever-present debate around automation and jobs dying? Because this has been a fascinating dynamic for me as someone who like studies the broad zeitgeist. In 2018, Andrew Yang is saying we need a UBI because all the truck drivers won't be able to have their jobs anymore and that pays a good middle-class wage. And it's 2022 and there's a trucker shortage because any of the self-driving cars didn't arrive, but there were a variety of like COVID era corrections that really impacted the industry's ability to recruit talent. So how do you, through the lens of the industrial economy, think of the automation debate?
You know, Marcel, I'm a big student of history, right? And you go back and look way back in the Industrial Revolution time, right? When the first printing press came out, when the first steam engine came out, people said gloom and doom, right? They said, and if you remember, right, when the first steam engine came up, people went and broke it down. They said, oh my God, you're going to kill my job, right? You know, the beautiful thing about human beings are, we are real. Right? We are not artificial intelligence. We are natural intelligence. We are super smart. And I always believe for generations, for decades, for centuries, there's always a gloom and doom of something happening which is going to wipe out mankind. Right? What I mean by that is, if you go to the 1700s, you know, the very first industrial revolution was going to make jobs redundant. Guess what? It did, but it created new jobs. And even as early as or as late as 2010, I remember there was a report which talked about, I forgot, like 46% of the jobs, and McKinsey did this work also, MGI, 46% of whatever that number is going to get automated and going to go away, and we're going to have 20 hours a week. I don't know about you, Marshall. I'm still working 60-hour weeks, right? Because whatever got automated away, right, there are other things where I, as a human being, can add value. And so you're going to see this constant, in a good way, treadmill towards us doing great things. Because, and I mean this, right? At the end of the day, I mean, this is not about a religious debate, Marshall, but at the end of the day, there's only one person who's really smart. And that's a human being, right? Because whether it is automation, robotics, machine, they do what we tell them to do, right? The conceptual problem solving, the empathy, thinking around the corner is all done by us. And I would much rather have us do that and do the repetitive task, right? Whether it is an automated welding or fabrication. And so long-winded way of saying, you know, let all the automation happen. Anything which is repetitive should be automated, because as a human being, we have more and more things to do, right? We have not even scratched the surface. And if I take an hour out of stuff you do, Marshall, I am 99% sure, or maybe even 100% sure, you're going to find that 1 hour to use productively somewhere else. And that is true at our level, and that is true at the sector level, right? So put it differently, I think automation is great, right? It frees up, to your point, right? Self-driving car is great because it frees up us to go do something else, which is even more valuable and adds more value to the society.
So for the last question and to wrap things, this is the theme I've been exploring recently on the podcast is this idea of we're rebalancing our mental frameworks and narratives. So the critique of the 70s could really be overemphasis on the financial services part of the economy. The critique of the 90s to basically very recently is the overemphasis on the digital side of the economy, and then therefore not prioritizing the tangible, the real. To your point, in 2015, people weren't thinking of semiconductors. In 2020, let's say January, I and most people had no conception of what a supply shortage could look like. It just, there's no model for that. So it seems to me that what we can do during this period to what's next is really balance financial services, balance industry, and balance tech. How do you think of, like, what do you see as a useful mix? Like, what would you say could be like the, what's a useful way to think of maybe finding a useful narrative around all these different and vital parts of an economy to wrap this for us?
Marshall, the way I would put it is, you know, the last 30 years, I mean, we have lived through it, right? Is what I call the era of disruption 1.0. Meaning we did the same things we did, but we did them differently. Right. So, for example, before you wanted a number, you went and looked up Yellow Pages. Today, you go do Google. Right. Before you wanted to stay in a hotel, you went and called Marriott and booked up a number. Today, you use Airbnb. Right. Same thing with Uber. But if you really look, I think the last 30 years has been what I call the generation of disruption 1.0. We keep doing the same things we did differently. I think now we are entering a period of disruption 2.0, Marshall, which I call doing different things, right? I don't know what they are. I mean, if I did, you know, yeah. I would be a billionaire, but you're already starting to see this, right? Like in industrials, what you're doing is you're finding to do different things. I mean, take medical, for example, right? Till recently, God forbid, you had an accident or something, you had to be operated and you had to be done. Now they're finding different innovations in medical technology, which is enabled by industrial technology, which allows you to save your life, which allows you to have a replacement, synthetic kidney and stuff like that, right? So I think the frame in my mind is, this is why, and you know, maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I think I'm right, is the next decade, we are going to be a decade of disruption 2.0, where we are going to do different things enabled by industrial technology. Right. And where all these, to your point, financial services, high tech, digital, all of them is going to come together. This is a period of inflection where we come together. The next decade, the next couple of decades, Marshall, I think we are going to live in a period when you and I are going to have this conversation in 2042, be like, wow, we're doing different things. Because if you look at the last 20 years, 30 years since the internet came on, you do the same things you and I did, except just differently. You used a phone, now you use a phone. I mean, that time it was a rotary phone, now you use a cell phone, right? Before you looked up Yellow Pages, now you go look up Google. But you do the same things. But I think the next decade, the next couple of decades, maybe even more than that, you and I are going to do different things, right? And I think that is what is going to make it exciting, because we're all going to be, again, like kids in a kindergarten going and learning stuff. And that is going to unleash the next wave of productivity, the next wave of improvement in the quality of life. And I think that's what is going to make it really exciting.
Yeah, that's very well stated. And when you're just making me think of this kind of this idea that there are plenty of, this is the whole Peter Thiel, stagnation idea. Like there are plenty of, if you took someone from the 1920s and showed them a washing machine, showed them even our most advanced fridge, obviously it's a wonder in the sense that, wow, this has gotten much better. But like at a core level, there's still something that they conceptualize about it. I think what's exciting, what you're saying is you're putting forth a vision, or at least the start of a vision of there being these different categories where you could take me, I was born in 1992, and you could not have taken my parents and then had them comprehend what you're doing in 2040. So I think that's a good place to leave things, because it's optimistic in a space that often is pessimistic. Nick, this has been really great. I think the request I'd have is, A, could you shout the book and your co-authors out? But then two, there are a lot of younger listeners to this podcast who are definitely skeptical of the received, like, most obvious track, whether that comes to higher education or taking a traditionally tracked career. Like, where should they go if they want to pursue careers in this space? Because to your point, this is not as simple as searching McKinsey.com and learning about, like, first-year associate jobs.
Yeah, so the book is The Titanium Economy, Marshall. It's released today on Amazon. I had the privilege, honor, working with two of my co-authors, Ashutosh Pati and Gaurav Batra. And to your question, look, this is the best part, right? I think that for the younger audience, look no further, right? There are so many manufacturing companies who are doing great. There are so many industrial companies doing great. It's not like tech where you say, okay, if I look at Google, if I don't look at Google, there's nobody else. There's lots of companies, right? So you don't need to look any further. But actually at Fernway, which is the investment company we launched, we actually are setting up, in lack of better words, an informational session, because we have self-interest to get people in. And so one of the things we are launching, and in the next few weeks, it's going to be up and running on the fernway.com website, is for any of our younger folks, if they're interested in entering the sector, we are doing a tutorial or a ask me anything, so that people know where to go look for it and who to connect with, so that they can really enter the sector either as a tradesman or as an electrician, and really, grow and also, more important or equally important, realize the career paths they can take and the trajectories they can have.
Very cool. We'll be sure to link that out in the podcast and the newsletter when that is out. Nick, thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.